Oi, você está no Hipsters Fora de Controle, o podcast spin-off que finalmente foca em apenas uma única modinha, inteligência artificial e suas aplicações.
Muito bem, para essa segunda parte a gente vai conversar, estou bem empolgado com essa conversa, com um dos responsáveis, o principal responsável, na verdade, por aquele Lumiere do Google, que a gente comentou faz um tempo, geração de vídeo a partir de texto, animar imagem, fazer painting de vídeo, etc. É o Omer Bartal, que, inclusive, desde o lançamento do Lumiere até agora, ele acabou saindo de lá, foi para a Paika, a gente vai falar também sobre isso, mas o papo aqui hoje vai ser sobre geração de vídeo, né, Fabrício?
É, exatamente, é uma área que me interessa bastante, eu tô bem animado para essa conversa. Ele veio lá, ele fez o bacharelado dele na Universidade de Tel Aviv, em Israel, fez também o mestrado dele no Weizmann Institute of Science, também lá em Israel, e agora, estando na Paika, a gente vai bater esse papo, né, sobre como foi desenvolver o Lumiere, né, fazer essa pesquisa sobre o Google Lumiere, na verdade, quando ele estava ainda na Google Research, e também sobre o presente e o futuro dele lá na Paika, na Pika Labs.
Exatamente, e como de costume com entrevistas com pessoas estrangeiras, no feed principal aqui que você vai ouvir agora é a versão traduzida com a ajuda do Eleven Labs, mas na descrição do episódio você encontra, é claro, o áudio original só do nosso papo com o Omer. So yeah, Omer, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really fun to have you here. And you worked on the Google Research team as a student on a project that turned out to be Lumiere, right? And recently you joined Paika as a founding scientist, congratulations, by the way, as a founding scientist, which is the video generation tool company that we've been talking about here for a while because it's very interesting. And we're here to talk about the underlying technology and the development of Lumiere, of course, within the boundaries of what you can tell us. But I think it's just fascinating to think about and talk about this sort of market dynamics as well, especially considering that many of our listeners are looking to build careers in development, some of them in AI and such. So what was it about Paika that got you interested and ultimately led you to go work with them? And what exactly is a founding scientist for people who don't know?
I think in general now, video generation and generative AI is a very fast moving field, and there are a lot of exciting advancements, in a very regular basis. And I think that a startup like Paika, in terms of the pace that we are working and the technology that we have is quite. I was quite impressed by it before joining. And I think there are many players in this field, including big companies and startup companies. I think actually working in a startup in this field has quite many advantages in terms of the speed. Everyone are very much driven by the goal of having the best text to video model and the best video product. And I think the team is very strong, technically speaking. Also, yeah. So about founding scientists. So the idea is basically to take a significant role in directing the research aspects that we are doing. And now, obviously, we are working on a better version of the model. So we're making a significant efforts there and expanding also in terms of researchers and
Right. And in these last few years, we saw an explosion of text to image tools, and only recently did we start seeing good products that offer image to actually text to video as well, right? So when it comes to the models, how much of the image generation technology can be transferred to video generation? And when do these paths start to diverge when it comes to the underlying technology that makes the whole thing work?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think in general, text to image, by itself is very, interesting and exciting technology. But when it comes to text to video, or in general, video editing or video tasks, not only when it's driven by text necessarily, is far more challenging actually. So there are very basic concepts that are that we can inherit from the text to image ideas. For example, the basic framework of diffusion models, which is quite popular today, and maybe some very general ideas in terms of model and architecture and generally the way we will train the model. But actually diverges once we want to actually achieve more realistic and more interesting motion characteristics. And in general, when we think about video, then it might sound like the difference between generating images and generating a video is maybe not that significant, but actually it's a very different in terms of the underlying technology and the different challenges. So first, data is quite a challenge in in video generation, we really need to get like very accurate data. And there's been a substantial work on images that is yet to be done on videos. And also in the core architectures, then video is much more expensive because just the dimensions are much larger. So if you want to generate long videos, then it's going to cost us quite a lot and it's going to be very slow. So we need to do a lot of efforts and research in this perspective. And generally speaking, even, you know, how to learn kind of a distribution of all possible videos is a very challenging task. And there is a lot of things that are we are looking into and things that we probably need to look into. But yeah, there are a lot of challenges that are pretty unique for videos.
Interesting. And Omar, can you please explain the core concept of Lumiere? You're the main author of the paper, right? And also what sets it apart from other previous text-to-video models?
So the main idea was relating to what I mentioned about the resource computation. So processing video is very, very expensive. And if you want to generate not, you know, extremely short clips, then it's going to be very slow and demand a lot of compute. So what we found in Lumiere and the basic idea was that videos, and you can think about it intuitively, different frames share a lot of content, right? Different frames in the video, like consecutive frames, are probably very similar. So we wanted to kind of leverage the redundancies in video data in order to incorporate compression in terms of the number of frames inside of the network architecture. So instead of processing all the frames in the network compresses the frames within the network itself, and this allows us to process many more frames. And the benefits there were both that we could just process, it was just an easier system, just we could just generate more frames with one model, but also that we found like very interesting properties that actually make it easier to learn a coherent motion. For example, if you want to generate a person walking, it's much more natural to generate it when we generate all the frames at once. And this is actually a limitation in generating coherent motion that previous approaches faced. Yeah, so the main idea was to leverage the redundancies in video data in order to make the network design more efficient.
Oh yeah, I see. And I feel that when you're talking about video, you even mentioned this before, is not only a matter of costs and the frames, but one thing that I feel that most text-to-video models could not do so well before, at the beginning, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, was to maintain consistency over time, right? And this is something that Lumiere can do. So what is the main challenge there? And how did you do it? How did you improve this architecture, this UNet architecture, in order to maintain the temporal consistency in the videos?
Yeah, so the previous approaches, mainly because of the resource demands of processing videos, were treating video generation as a task where you first generate very distant keyframes, and then you go in non-overlapping windows and kind of fill in the content in between. But the problem in this approach, and it relates to the consistency, is that it's very difficult to maintain consistency throughout the video because you process different chunks independently. Right? So it's very non-natural, even if you think about it, when you think about a video, think about, you know, the entire scene, not about different chunks. And, you know, so this was quite a limitation in maintaining a global consistency in various models. And the different aspects of consistency, there is this global consistency, there is more the short-term or local consistency, just making sure that nearby frames are not going to be jittery. Right, so this is also something that we worked on Lumiere. So we increased the resolution. When we generated high-resolution videos, we made sure that this is being done in a temporally aware manner. So each frame, when we upsample it in the height and width dimensions, it's being aware of what the other frames are, like how the other frames are going to be upsampled, to make sure that even all the fine details are going to be consistent. So this approach, generally the aware method that also did what's called temporally aware super resolution, but other methods did not do it just because of the complexity that it may involve. And again, the computational requirements.
Right. And the model is described as the space-time diffusion model for video generation, right? So just so we can make sense, better sense of the technology, what would other uses for a space-time diffusion model be other than for video generation? Is there such a thing?
So I think in general, when we have video generation models, then we can also use them for a bunch of different downstream applications and editing cases. And we actually saw that in Lumiere that we can inpaint different regions or just perform stylization or different kind of very nice applications that were quite readily available, given that we already have the base model, like the foundation model itself. And I think that, you know, to make an analogy, then we can look at what happened in text-to-image models. So there was a time where users just generated very, very creative images, and it was very, I mean, nice by itself. But I think even a very exciting progress afterwards was how to adapt these models for different editing cases, right? So we can either control the generation very well or just use the model to edit our own images, right? And then we can get much more creative, and you know, it's much more appealing sometimes to edit your own images and not just to generate some images. So this is definitely something that is super relevant also in text to video models, and we showed some of the applications in the paper, but it's really only in the beginning. There are a variety of different applications that are very exciting.
And I want to tackle this part about the hardware that you mentioned so much, like the computational efficiency and how much computational power you actually need to train and to run these models. You are doing this within Google, I suppose. So how was the, if you can talk about this, of course, what was the type of cluster that you had in your hands that you could use to train and to run these models there? And when you talk about running this for a bigger audience, for example, like people are doing right nowadays with Google Gemini, for example, or with ChatGPT, Midjourney for images, whatever, Pika for video as well. Do you think we already have the necessary power, or the cost is still way too high and is not really ready to be available to a greater public?
Yeah, so I think in general, developing foundation models is usually requires many resources. Even if you are in a big company, and even if you have access, you know, to many resources, then it's still maybe demanding. But in terms of, you know, how much its users can use these technologies, then I think actually Pika is a great example. I mean, our models are being accessible to all users, and you can generate videos very easily just using the web interface. And you can generate either videos or editor videos and perform different kind of applications. So, you know, kind of the backend side, the Pika is going to do the computation with our own resources, but the user doesn't just needs an access to a computer and to an internet in order to create this video. So in a user perspective, I think it's actually quite accessible in this sense. Now, of course, that, you know, when we want to generate longer videos or enable more applications, then, for example, in Pika, we would like to somehow make it more efficient, you know, in order to, so that the runtime will be better and so on. But the actual user doesn't need access to any of these clusters or computational resources, because, I mean, you just can access it from a web UI. And even maybe, I guess, a different kind of users, even like researchers that try to build their ideas based on different video models, then many times there can be like very interesting applications just by adapting the model without actually training the entire model, which is much more expensive. And there are many works, especially in the image case, of researchers taking accessible image models that are very difficult to train. But once they are already trained, you can do so many applications with them in a very lightweight manner.
Yeah, of course. I was asking more about in the case of like maybe you are a company and you need to run these models, of course, because when I was running some Stable Diffusion models on my home laptop, it would take maybe, I don't know, like 5 to 6 minutes to generate one image or like a set of four images. And for video, I imagine that since you have like so many frames, it wouldn't be possible maybe to run this on my home computer.
Yeah, so it will be certainly take maybe more time, but I think that in general, when it comes to video, people are now more interested in, you know, getting the best quality, and kind of maybe even if it requires much more memory or much more, you know, runtime, just because it's very new, and you know, we are not yet as the capabilities themselves are not yet established. I think once we'll reach there, then there will be more effort on just making it more efficient. But I think first, we just want to kind of tackle the capability and the overall quality that we can reach. And then, you know, maybe there will be more efforts on making it more accessible in terms of memory. And even in the case of images, then at first when Stable Diffusion was released, it was not feasible to run it on a computer. You at least had to have access to some GPUs, and still it could be quite demanding in terms of compute. But, you know, just a few months later, then after the quality of the image generation was kind of good enough, then there were a lot of people just working on optimizing the runtime. And today, I mean, as you mentioned, you can even write from your own computer, but it's really not, you know, shouldn't be taken for granted, because even text-to-image models are huge and, you know, also very much demanding in terms of compute.
Right. And a few weeks after Lumiere was announced, OpenAI announced Sora, which also made this big splash, right? And it's something that there's no real ETA aside from this year, late this year, that Mira Murati said in that weird Wall Street Journal interview. So sort of like the behind the scenes question, if you can answer, of course. Did you know that something was up, that maybe Sora was about to come out? And could you maybe talk a little bit about how Lumiere is different, or maybe similar, or the different approaches between the way you did Lumiere and how OpenAI used the whole world simulation model thing, the pros and cons of each method?
Yeah, so I think while working on Lumiere, then obviously, I mean, in general, I think when working on generative models, then you kind of assume that, you know, you need to be fast enough, because otherwise other people are going to have, like, you know, very major releases before you. And it's, you know, so the pace is quite incredible. And of course, that all the time we were thinking, like, what will be, like, the models from different companies, different competitors. And we're, like, kind of looking forward for, I mean, we hoped, of course, that we will do better, but we were very curious about what they're baking. So, yeah, and then a few weeks later, Sora came out. So, yeah, I think we still had, like, you know, few weeks of buzz until it moved to mostly to OpenAI. I think the results are quite remarkable. I mean, this is something that it's quite apparent. And even if it will take them, you know, quite a while until to make it actually a product. And I think that, you know, making such technology a product, there is, like, usually a long time, because it needs to be robust, needs to be efficient. And you probably wouldn't want to wait for, like, 30 minutes until you get a video and so on. Now, in terms of the overall approach and technology, they didn't reveal much information. Actually, they revealed very little information, but in a maybe very high level manner, according to, I mean, one way to understand what they have written is that they process the entire video all together, which is something in a very high level manner, similar to Lumiere, where we didn't take what's usually referred to as cascaded approach, where again, you first generate very distant frames and then fill in the content independently, but rather, like, generate everything at once, or generate very significant chunks at least at once. So it seems like they also took a similar approach, and it probably enabled them to generate very coherent motion. Now, in the more model design aspect, then they took a very different approach, actually, in terms of the actual architecture. But there aren't too many, I guess, details, so, you know, it's very difficult to speculate. Now, in terms of in a higher level, then the general approach of training a diffusion model is still shared, and it seems like this is quite established today. In terms of, there are, of course, different tweaks, but it's overall the same framework.
About this, like, how you trained Lumiere and how you suppose that they trained Sora, I'd like to ask about the database. So what is this database that you use to train it? Like, I suppose there are videos there, of course, or mostly videos, but do you have, like, to tag, like, to create, like, a supervised model, basically, like, to type what is in the video? Or do you have, like, another LLM, like a multimodal LLM, that can get what is contained in each frame, and then it does this thing for you?
Yeah, in general, there are more image data sets than video data sets. So typically, people usually either first train their model on images only, and then continue training on videos. So this is what we did in Lumiere. Other approaches is just to train jointly. This is more like implementation difference, but generally, usually, it's quite common to train both on images and videos. Now, when it comes to videos, then, yeah, it is supervised setting. So you need pairs of text descriptions and the videos. And in order to obtain these videos, then usually it's quite common to apply some captioning model, and the exact way to apply it can vary a lot. But yeah, there are some automatic ways to obtain captions, or, you know, semi-automatic ways, but it's not entirely manual when it comes to scale. Now, something that they mentioned also in Sorain is also quite actually common practice, is to make sure that the captions, the text descriptions, are informative enough, right? So you can think about it intuitively, that if you want to describe a video of a dog and you just have the caption "a dog," then it doesn't reveal a lot of information. I mean, there can be like so many different dogs, and the dogs can do like so many different actions. So if the model just needs to understand how to generate a dog just based on the fact that there needs to be a dog, it's a very challenging setting. It needs to kind of figure out the entire scene and the entire action. So it's quite common and quite established that it's much better, significantly better, to have more descriptive captions that describe, to a much higher extent, the appearance, the motion, and so on. So they mentioned this in the SOA report, I think, and it was also being incorporated in DALL-E 3, where they did like a significant improvement, actually a very impressive improvement, just by making the captions much more descriptive. And even when a user provides a prompt, I mean, maybe, you know, the end user will just want to generate a dog and just want the model to be creative. But sometimes behind the scenes, there is some language model that kind of enriches this caption and hallucinate, more informative scene. And then the actual text-to-image model, text-to-video model, needs to be like a much easier, needs to fulfill a much easier task, because most of the details are already, I mean, not most, but a lot of the details are already determined by the text.
And when you talk about the results that you get, like after you type something like a prompt into Lumiere, into Sora, the quality of the results, like some of the examples that we saw, they are really crazy. They're like amazingly good in terms of like HD, 4K, whatever. So how do you ensure that the model creates that and not the video from Will Smith eating pasta from 2 years ago?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think that a lot of it also relates to the data quality. I mean, it might sound a very, very obvious, but if the training data contains, you know, videos of Will Smith, I mean, eating like low resolution videos, then it will be very difficult or impossible to generate, you know, high resolution, high quality videos. But if the data sets contain, you know, very high quality videos or images, then the overall quality afterwards will be better, which sounds very obvious, but, you know, the importance of the data is very significant. And many times there are, even like prompt engineering tricks. You know, sometimes you just write high quality and just like changes the entire, it really increases the quality. And even in text to image, I mean, it's quite known that, you know, all these prompting tricks can actually help. And it goes back to the previous point I mentioned about, you know, having the captions descriptive enough. So if they're, you know, they accurately describe also the level of, you know, just how good the videos look, then it can also help. And these are all things that are already quite established and even in images, but are quite transferable in videos. And yeah, of course, you know, there are cases where they just work much better than others, and it's unclear even why.
So we recently interviewed a Stanford researcher who basically accidentally came across DPO, which was this new method of rewarding Gen AI models that was different and much better, actually, than the traditional RLHF, right? And I'm mentioning this because it's just one of the many examples that we've seen lately, especially in these last years, that a big breakthrough discovery, especially in AI, was sort of by accident, which is always so funny to think about. So you start poking around with something, the model starts behaving in a different way, and it turns out it's a much better way than you intended in the first place. So as far as I understand it, the space-time UNet architecture of Lumiere builds on top of the more traditional, maybe UNet architecture, which has been on for like 10 years. So the question is, did you have this end goal, the space-time UNet architecture, in mind from the start, or was it more of this poking around, taking on the new research, seeing where it led, and turns out you reached the actual the model Lumiere?
It's a great question, because the answer is like it was definitely not the first thing we thought of, and we actually I think at the very beginning we kind of like maybe thought that it makes sense to that, of course, that, you know, it will be expensive to process videos if you need to process all frames throughout the network. And then we kind of tried to think of like, what can we do about it? And I think we even raised the idea of, you know, having the space-time unit at the very beginning of the project, and then just say that it just doesn't make sense and it probably will not work. And then we tried like, and then we kind of like left it aside and tried a bunch of like different, completely different things. And eventually we said, okay, maybe we should just like try the space-time unit idea. And then it was actually working very well. And I think that in general, the basic idea of, you know, performing compression in the temporal dimension is very intuitive. And even after that it worked, then we kind of ask ourselves, how come nobody thought about it before? But I guess that it's also because we also, I mean, even ourselves, we first thought about this idea and then just thought that it might just not work, because it just sounds like there might be so many problems, and we just thought about all the different issues that can be happening. So yeah, it's actually very interesting. I think that in general, many times you start working with something and then end up with, you know, the final outcome. Here we actually started from some idea and then like thought that it probably would not work and tried a bunch of other ideas and then came back to the original idea. So it was quite interesting, actually, I think, you know, the trajectory of this project.
That's awesome. Now, regarding safety, maybe red teaming, and of course, within what you can share with us, what is the process of developing this technology, which can be used for pretty much anything you can imagine, which is awesome, but also trying to make sure it's not misused for scamming or even worse things that we know that can happen?
Yeah, so I think in general, this is something that, you know, people take into account quite a lot, of course. So usually, you know, you kind of test and try to understand the biases of the model. And, you know, even in models that are not text-to-image models, even in models like CLIP, right, that feels maybe very ancient today, then there were methods that were using a CLIP for different editing or different generation, even before the all the diffusion text-to-image models. And even there, there were biases of CLIP. So it was quite a while ago, but there was this trend of combining CLIP with different generative models like VQGAN, or with like diffusion models that are not conditioned on text. And many times, you know, depending on the prompt, you would convert to solutions that, you know, just it's very clear that there are some very specific associations. And, you know, some of them might be, you know, more alarming, but actually some of them are just not in, maybe, you know, we don't have problem with, but are just a bit funny. So for example, I had a project text to live where we did image and video editing with CLIP. Actually, it was before text to image and way before text to video models, and we noticed it was quite a funny limitation, actually, that when we wanted to generate a moon, then it was very difficult to generate like a full moon, because just CLIP really wanted to generate, you know, like not a full moon. So obviously this is like, you know, a very funny limitation. It doesn't, you know, I guess nobody will be concerned about it too much, but still, I mean, it was quite apparent. It was very difficult to generate, you know, a full moon because just CLIP really has like a prior about a very specific shape of a moon. And there were even other limitations. You know, we tried to generate a, what I had in mind in a chess cake is kind of having, you know, a cake, you know, with kind of the chess board on top of the cake. That's what I had in mind. But CLIP really wanted to generate like chess pieces, like on top of like the king and so on. And, you know, so these limitations were, you know, at the time quite funny. And, you know, today there are different kinds of limitations that, you know, might be more alarming. But it's essentially very much the same. And I think all models have their own limitations that are biases that depend basically on the data. So, you know, one approach that is just to analyze, to understand what are the biases just by observing the data. And sometimes it might even be easier to just check it with the actual model just by generating images or so on. And yeah, I think this is some concern that everyone, you know, who make the text to image or video model accessible certainly discuss and, you know, try to mitigate.
Yeah, we had a situation some weeks ago with people generating things like, I don't know, black Nazis, black founding fathers, indigenous people in the Viking era, using the Google model, right? So this kind of restrictions that you mentioned, are they done during training level, like during the training time, or they are more during the result, like the prompting time, that you kind of edit or check the prompt that the user is making and kind of change it?
Yeah, so I think even before this Gemini trend, even back then with DALL-E 2, I remember that people were also like that noticed that at some point just the kind of generation kind of changed in one day and speculated that, like, try to think what happened. And generally speaking, then, yeah, I mean, you could approach it in the data side, which might seem more intuitive, but also, like, as we, as I mentioned before, with the prompting, then sometimes you can just hack it, you know, right, with changing the prompt. So I think all different, there are many approaches, and all of them have, you know, their own, they work to some extent. So many times, you know, we can combine, and there are actually very interesting papers that are trying to mitigate biases in a more fundamental manner, kind of analyzing what the model learned in terms of the actual, like, the weight, the actual model itself, the parameters, and try to change it, to adapt it. This is very interesting research topics, both in language, like in LLMs, and in visual models, mostly in text-to-image, just because text-to-video is, like, you know, too new. So there are very various approaches, and I think, you know, overall, I think that in order to actually mitigate this, you kind of need, you know, to approach it from different fronts, because each one has works in different scope. For example, the prompting, I mean, it could be quite difficult to now, you know, think about all possible, like, to maybe you will, like, some users can be very creative with the prompt and kind of hack it. I think there were users that did it with ChatGPT even, right?
Yeah, we even saw some weeks ago, it was called Art Prompting, a paper that some people released, where they mask a part of the prompt and they use ASCII art instead of it to replace it. And then the LLM responds, like, it replies with something that it shouldn't, in theory. So there's always this thing, like, with red teaming. I mean, it's going to be there forever, right?
Right.
Yeah, that of course touches a little bit on the issue of regulation, right? Which is a subject, it's a hot subject that many people have been waking up to maybe for the last year, 2 years maybe. And I think that usually when people talk about regulation, it's not very productive, because you have two very well-established sides that just keep repeating their own point of view, and there's not much conversation, not much exchange, right? So how do you think would be a more productive way to approach this subject? Because it is important, especially when it comes to image and especially video generation. How do you see one way out to actually try to move forward this?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, I personally think that actually it relates to the previous thing that you mentioned. For example, when users try to, like, let's say the model, if you just try to innocently, like, generate different images, and there are all these, like, systems that are not perfect in to kind of mitigate biases. Now, if the users really try to hack it, they might generate, you know, they can still maybe bypass it. So, I mean, it's a question. I mean, should you blame the AI system or the users, right? I mean, because if they really try to hack the system for generating this, then, I mean, there is maybe so much that we can do. So I personally think that, you know, there needs to be some, you know, kind of a line, you know, between things that the model generated, you know, innocent users may just, like, prompt something and get disturbing results, and, you know, these users actually hack the model, you know, to generate, like, bad results. And, like, so maybe also in terms of safety, I personally think that it's less maybe relevant to protect from users that actually try to hack the model, right? So yeah, it feels like, you know, maybe it would be very difficult to convince some people that are very, like, have their very strong opinions regarding safety. And I think that maybe in any technological advancement that is very significant, there will always be, you know, more skeptics and people that are more, you know, look at the downsides. But I think in the long run, you just can't ignore the advantages. And so I think that I personally think that it will just, you know, last.
I'd like to tackle one more controversial topic since we're talking about regulation. I think it falls into the same category, kind of, which is talking again about the databases that are used for training these models. Like, there was a huge controversy in the past year or year and a half about artists that were not communicated by the companies that are creating these models. So they put their art online on Instagram, Shutterstock, whatever, and the companies supposedly just took this art with the captions or without the captions, doesn't matter, to train these models. So I'd like to know about your take on that.
Yeah, so I think it's quite interesting because in general, I think that maybe there are more innocent examples where you might collect, you know, images, even in the text-to-image case, like images of different art pieces, and maybe it's like, you know, didn't even know that you collected this just because it was happened to be in some data set that's supposed to be, you know, publicly available and licensed even. And maybe there are cases where, you know, deliberately like scrape such examples. So maybe there needs to be like, some differentiation between these two cases. I think it's a very interesting topic because in one hand, I think that, you know, it's quite probably important, you know, to protect, you know, copyrights. On the other hand, I think this entire field just very new, and even in terms of legislation, you know, everything is unprecedented. It's still, I think there haven't been such cases in the past, so it will take some time to kind of understand how to tackle this and how to approach this problem. So I think everything is just too fast in order to have, like, you know, understand the consequences, you know, the importance of different things. And I think it's actually quite different from, I mean, there are similarities and dissimilarities between these problems and what happened in music, you know, that there was a time before Spotify that everyone just, you know, downloaded illegal music, and it was pretty common, I think. And today, I think it's actually pretty common to, you know, pay a few dollars for Spotify. But these things take time, right? Because, you know, a lot of changes in technology and, I guess, society and, like, in, you know, users. So I think that's actually too early to actually have a very clear answer about this.
Right. So looking ahead now, and maybe talking a little bit about the work that you intend to develop on Pika, what excites you about what's coming? Maybe near term, maybe longer term? What's down the road that you can already see or that you have ideas to develop that are exciting and should be on the lookout for?
So first, I think that in terms of text to video, it's still impossible today to really just type a text prompt and just get, you know, a really good result, like that is also longer, the quality is just amazing, and that you don't really need to tweak the system a lot, you know, to really get, like, you know, let's say a 30 seconds clip and something like this. But actually, this is very exciting, but I think this is actually maybe the least exciting part compared to other things. So other things I think that are more exciting is how to use these models actually for editing cases. Because many times, you know, editing is, I think, can also be relevant for many more people. You know, sometimes you just need to edit, or just even if you want to generate content, you might want to generate it, you know, as part of a scene that is given, right? So maybe you took some video and you just want to change some part of it in a more sophisticated manner, or like add new content, or maybe you want to just add to create a story, right? Where you don't really have like only a dog that is doing some action, but you have something that is more interesting, that involves like maybe different scenes and maybe also parts of images, and some of the content is, you know, from user provided, some of the content is going to be only AI generated. Actually, to make the entire content creation process much more than just, you know, generating videos per se. So I think that, you know, generating videos is kind of like the first milestone, but there are so many other things that are super relevant for content creation and creativity.
When you talk about text to video, I think the first thing that comes to people's minds is movies. Like, when we're going to be able to create a full movie, like a 1.5 hour, 2 hour movie, only using text to video. And in your opinion, when is that going to be?
So, yeah, I think it relates to the previous question. I think that it's unclear to me even if we need, you know, movies that are all AI generated. I mean, because there is also the part of creating the movie, which requires a lot of creativity and, you know, ideas. It is not only about, you know, generating the pixels, but also about thinking about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, how to combine different scenes, combine different even camera angles. It's much more than just, you know, being able to generate some character during some action. So I think that using AI tools and video models to make it much easier, you know, for, you know, everyday users to create movies is something that is very interesting. But I think it's not going to be, you know, just that, you know, a Netflix movie is going to be generated only from a prompt, you know, generated Netflix movie. Because
in theory, it can, right? It's just expensive.
Right. Yeah, I just think that, you know, a lot of the... It's an, in a sense, like, I think inventing the camera didn't, you know, destroy the art sector, right? And you still need, you know, someone to think about, you know, how to take these photos. Even if you can, the acquisition is much easier and you don't need to paint before. So I think it's actually similar. I mean, these models will be a tool for creators, and but they're not going to be the creators.
Another last question from me, Omar. If folks at home that are listening to this conversation, they want to get into this field of computer vision, of AI, how do you recommend they do it?
I think today everything is actually very much accessible. Probably a very good way will just be to generate some image with Stable Diffusion, with some open source model. And that's like, you know, just the first, very first thing, to a bit get excited about the result. And then there are a lot of open source, actually, libraries and tutorials that are very, very good in explaining exactly the process of what happened, you know, to actually generate the image. And there are a lot of developments that are being done by actually very novice people, that even if people that are not experts in the field, they can still have very interesting impact.
Right. Umber, thank you very much for your time. I'm sure folks are going to love this conversation. If our listeners want to continue this conversation directly with you, where should they go?
You can refer maybe to my email account or my Twitter account and send messages and be happy to answer.
Perfect. Links will be in the description. E para você que se empolgou com essa conversa, quiser mergulhar no mercado de IA generativa ou de IA, para você que é uma pessoa criativa, você pode passar aqui na descrição do episódio e dar uma espiadinha no curso Inteligência Artificial Generativa Midjourney e ChatGPT na Alura. Isso faz parte de um leque muito maior de cursos e formações que tem a ver com IA para pessoas de vários perfis. Então, para a galera que é mais de código, para a galera que é de UX, galera de dados, você também que é uma pessoa criativa, passa aqui na descrição, dá uma espiadinha. Você também pode ter acesso à Luri, que é a inteligência artificial da Lura, feita junto com o ChatGPT. E link na descrição, junto também do link para você se inscrever na newsletter Fora de Controle do Fabrício, que ele manda toda terça-feira de manhãzinha, com notícias, com prompt da semana também, que o pessoal está mandando prompt, tem a imagem gerada pelo prompt que vocês mandam, claro, com créditos também. Então tá tudo na descrição aqui do episódio. Hipsters, obrigado pela audiência de vocês, e a gente volta na semana que vem. Hipsters, abraços, tchau.
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura, mergulhe em tecnologia, e Faculdade FIAP, Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.